Hi everyone, welcome to Hacker Public Radio. My name's Klaatu. I have a three-part series for you this time on packaging, actually. Packaging code for Linux, and BSD. So, I'm not a package maintainer, really. I'm very, very novice at it, but I don't really hear... I've never actually heard an episode on the subject. And I maintain a couple of packages over at slackbuilds.org, and I built an RPM, and I built a port once. So, very, very much a novice, but in this episode I'm going to discuss Slack builds. And I'm going to discuss Slack builds first, because I don't know necessarily that it was a terribly early development. I don't know when this was all devised. I don't know the history of really any packaging formats, but I figured it was a really good one to start with because it is, in my opinion, the simplest to understand, the most straightforward one of them. It's the one that I kind of started with first. So, packaging Linux applications, of course, is a pretty important task, I think. I mean, one of the selling points, I think, maybe not at first, but one of those things that becomes very, very addictive and very, very almost expected at this point is that when you are using Linux, that at some point you start to just kind of expect naturally that application that you just heard about from someone, naturally that will be in your repository. It's just kind of a given. So I wanted to encourage people to look into packaging because it's a pretty cool little trick to know, and it can be very helpful to other people as well, because if there's an application out there that hasn't been packaged for your favorite distribution, or that's maybe lagging a little bit behind the curve, then you might be the person to pick that up. So, we'll get started with Slack building. Now, of course, I'm fully aware that not everyone's going to jump out of their chair at the end of this episode and go package stuff for Slackware. But it really is a very beautiful packaging format, the Slackware packaging, because it doesn't use anything specific to Slackware. Well, it does, but it doesn't. The Slackware packaging format is a shell script, and the shell script goes through the code that you want to compile, and it sets up a little destination directory, sort of a temporary directory, where everything is going to be compiled and then installed into that temporary directory. A couple of other files in the package, we'll get into that later, but at the basis there's this little shell script. It's the Slack build itself, a shell script, and it compiles the code, puts everything into this directory. Now if you look at this directory, inside the directory there is, if you go into that directory, you would almost think you were inside of your computer, because you'll see really familiar folders like /USR and /Etsy. And you'll think, gee, what's in there? So you go into /USR, and look at that. There's a /bin. You go into /bin, and there's the program that you were compiling, the binary for that program. Back out of there, go into the Etsy directory, maybe, and maybe there's another folder in there, or maybe not, but there's a .conf file for the application that you're compiling. And then maybe you go back out, and maybe there's a /USR/share/doc, and then there's the documentation. So basically, this little destination directory is a little tiny clone of a Linux system without anything in it except the application that you want to compile. So you've just taken source code, you've compiled it into its own little folder. It's completely bundled up in this one folder with lots of subfolders that correspond exactly to a Linux system, so that if you, specifically to a Slackware system, but that's pretty universal. So if you overlay that directory onto a Linux system, then suddenly you've installed that application. Makes sense, right? So in theory, of course, you could go through, you could give that folder to people, you could zip it up and give it to people, and they could unzip it, and they could move everything that you've compiled. If it was compiled for their architecture and everything, they could move everything that was compiled onto their computer in the corresponding places, meaning if it's this destination directory and they see a /USR/bin/whatever, then they'll take that whatever and they'll put it in /USR/bin/whatever. And then they would go into the /USR/share/doc, and they would take all the documentation and drop it into their own /USR/share/documentation. And the same thing for the Etsy config file. They would take it out of the Etsy folder in their little destination directory, and they'd put it into their own computer's Etsy folder. And if you think about it, that's all installing software is, right? There's nothing really magical going on there. Now, the one thing that is a little bit magical, or it might seem that way, is that there are dependencies. There's code on the computer that when you're building that application, it kind of wants to see that code. It wants to build against that code. If the user doesn't have that code on their computer when they're compiling the code, then that application isn't going to be able to compile. And that, of course, is a dependency. That's what that's all about. So for this reason, Slack building is kind of one of the easier packaging formats, because it doesn't do dependency resolution. It doesn't do any kind of checking. It simply runs the ./configure or whatever option that particular brand of compiling takes. It's usually a ./configure. And if the ./configure check fails, then it cannot proceed to actually make the program. So the burden is on the user, the Slackware user, to resolve their own dependencies. So enough talk, let's just go ahead and build something. And the program that I've chosen to build in all three of these demonstrations in each episode is the little program called Yes Please. Yes Please is a little C application, I think, by Sigflup. You remember Sigflup of Hacker Public Radio. She's a great programmer type person, and she came up with this Yes Please program that will take a screenshot of your computer screen, of your desktop, and then it will automatically upload it to the fine website, unixporn.com. Now, Unix porn, of course, is not porn, it's Unix, and it's a place where people can post their desktops, just whatever they're looking at, you know, during the day on their Linux machine, or BSD, or whatever, Solaris, whatever, and they can post it on there, then everyone gets to see, you know, how they have their computer set up. So it's just gratuitous screenshots, basically. So you need an account over at Unix Porn. It's a free account. It's just like me and the Last Known God and Cobra 2 admin the thing. Oh, and I think 330 technically. We're adminning the thing, and you can just use Yes Please to upload to it straight from the command line. It's a really slick little application, and it's got just enough complexity, I think, to make it not a completely easy script to write, a package to write, but it's at the same time, it is very simple because it's a very small application. So let's take a look at it. The Yes Please source is currently, at least the one that I've built packages for, is yesplease_aug_4, that's aug as in August, _4_2010.tgz. That's the source file that Sigflup distributes. That's the source code and everything in there. So for a Slack build, what you would do is you would grab that source. Well, actually, I should start out by saying, and this is going to be common on all three packaging formats, or all three that I'm going to cover. Sorry, I didn't mean to imply that they were the only three packaging formats. If you think that those are the only three packaging formats, go listen to HPR episode 733 by Marcos, where he talks about just how many packaging formats there really are. But I'm doing Slack builds, RPM, and port, because those are the ones that I learned, and that's why I'm doing them. Slack builds and RPMs I actually use a lot. Port was kind of fun, and the other ones I haven't gotten around to really looking into them. So for any package that you're going to be doing, it's a good idea to have kind of an environment, like a building environment set up, as well as a clean install set up. And those are two tall-ish orders, because if you're lazy, you won't want to do them. But it is important to do them, especially for something like RPM, which apparently was traditionally at one point kind of done by root, because it had a lot of, you know, it was the RPM builds were done outside of the home folder and stuff like that. And people kind of decided, you know, that's really crazy to be just sitting in root all day while you're packaging this thing up. And yeah, it's probably true. It does seem pretty crazy. So it's a good idea to kind of make your own packaging identity. And I mean, I always have at least two users on every computer I have. My everyday normal computer usage, and then another account just kind of just there hanging out, because I like to have multi-users, just because I like to explore what interesting things happen when you have two users, even though they're both me. But so if you can do an add user or a user add, whatever you've got on your system, and just create a new user for yourself who will be your packaging identity, that's not a bad idea. Now, at the same time, before you go doing that, another way about that and this isn't a bad way, believe me, is to just grab QEMU, Kemu, however you say that, the virtualizer, and grab the latest distribution of your distribution and fire up an instance of QEMU and do a little install of that. QEMU, I've done either a Hacker Public Radio episode on it, or I've done a binrev blog, which is also now sort of mirrored over on my Gopher space. Point Gopher, like in Lynx or in Firefox, Gopher /slackermedia.info:70, and you'll find a link to my Gopher space from there. So you can look up the QEMU tutorial in my articles, and it's a really simple one. I like using QEMU because it's fast and it's easy. You don't have to worry about installing a whole virtual machine client, like VirtualBox or anything, or Vert Manager or anything like that. You can just fire up a quick instance of QEMU, make a disk image, and then install your distribution on there. Do a minimal install, possibly, and you're good to go. You don't even need X for it. I mean, this is all going to be on the command line, so you can just install a really simple version of of the distribution that you're packaging for. And it really is quite important to do this in a virtual machine, because I cannot tell you how many times before I really, really understood packaging. Not to say that I really, really understand it now, but I certainly understand it better than I did when I was first starting out, but I can't tell you how many times I would write a Slack build on my machine for swearing that I've got a fairly clean machine, and of course there'll be something that I forgot that I had installed a hugely major dependency of this application, and I just never notice that it's there because I've already got it on my computer. Whereas if it was a clean install, a completely clean install, and I was packaging the thing, I would have known right away that when I did the /configure, oops, it didn't work because, such and such was missing. So it's very important to have a really, really clean install so that you're building against what you really kind of have to assume everyone else is going to be building against. You have to assume that they're starting from ground zero, from the ground up, from their distribution. Okay, so that's very important. It's all free. It's very easy to get started. The next thing, I guess, would be if you're not familiar with compiling software. If you're not familiar with compiling software, I did an episode on that over on GNU World Order, for sure. So that's ogcastplanet.org/GNU World Order. I don't remember the episode number, but it's an episode completely about compiling software. So if you're not familiar with it and you feel like I'm rushing through parts in this episode, you can either go listen to that. And Yes Please, like I say, is a really good little application to practice on, too. So if you haven't compiled that often and you want just sort of practice, Yes Please is great, because there's a couple of little dependencies, and then you can resolve those, and suddenly you're building, and it works, and everything's great. Okay, so we've grabbed the Yes Please source from the homepage, and honestly, the easiest way to get there, the way that I get there, is I simply go to slackbuilds.org, because, heck, that's what we're doing anyway, and you can even grab the Slack build if you want to kind of follow along, as it were. So if you go to slackbuilds.org, down at the bottom of, well, at the top of the page, there's a search box, and it'll be set by default to 13.37, so just put in the word Yes Please, and that is YESPLZ, and then hit return, and it'll take you to the Yes Please Slack build. And you'll see a README with some ASCII art that doesn't quite translate very well to HTML, unfortunately, and then you'll see a source download with the MD5 sum next to it. You can download that to your computer, and then right underneath that you'll see download Slack build, and that's going to be yesplease.tar.gz, and that is signed, GPG signed, so you can verify that, and then you should have in your little packaging identity, wherever that is, whether it's on a virtual machine, I make a directory called Slack building, and I put the source and the Slack build template that I'm going to use, which slackbuilds.org actually even provides. So in terms of getting it to work, it's a great starting point. Okay, so I'm going to just untar this yesplease.tar.gz. So that's the Slack build itself. Not the source code, just the actual Slack build. Like I've said, there are either four or five essential files in a Slack build. Again, this will be really similar in RPM and everything like that. They've typically got a pretty standard format, and they're all actually more similar than they are not in many ways. So the first file is the easy one. That's the README. Those are always good to have. I tend to try to be very verbose in my READMEs. I never want to assume that someone's coming to Slack builds and getting Yes Please because they know everything and they're doing it all from the command line in one command. That's just, you know, I like to try to assume that people are going to need a README. If they're reading the README, they probably want the information. At the same time, I don't want to go on and on either. I want to kind of be informative up at the top and then kind of break it down for people down at the bottom. Having said that, the Yes Please README is marvelously useless. I should probably work on that. But usually my READMEs are quite helpful. But the README, there's no format, there's no requirement. The README is a README. It's something that you can talk to the user through and kind of help them do whatever you think that they need to do in order to get that thing installed. Okay, so the next one is a little bit more specific, actually quite specific. It's called the Slack dash description, really, but it's dash DESC, and it's very, very specific about what you must do. It has a handy little ruler at the top, which is a bunch of dashes. It's got the application name down the left side of the document, and then it's got a place for text. So it's about, I think it's probably about 80 characters wide, I would imagine, or 79 or so, within that handy ruler. And then you've got 11 lines to use. So you can say whatever you need to say in that 11 lines, but you have to be careful not to go over that or go outside of that ruler, because what they're going to do is crop all that junk off and show the contents of the Slack description within the little package management tools that Slackware ships with by default. So you have to follow the format here, and of course in any packaging format you're going to find that there's files that are very specific, obviously, because it's all scripted, right? I mean, so they need everything to be exactly the same all the time. So traditionally in the Slack description, you place the title at the top of the description, of the 11 lines of description. Then you give like a brief description of what exactly this is, so that when people are kind of just browsing through the packages, they'll see, oh, Yes Please is sigflupsunixporn.com CLI screenshot and upload tool. Okay, I get it. That sounds interesting. I'll download that. And then typically it's very handy at the bottom of your description to either have like a link to the home page of that software so that they can go check it out if they want to, but also definitely have what dependencies are required. So I simply write, this requires, for instance, in this case, libjpeg, x11, and pthreads. Now in this case, happily, because it's Slackware, all of those are included in a stock Slackware install. So the user actually doesn't have to go out and resolve any dependencies. They can simply go to Yes Please, they can do the install script, and that's it. That's the end. They don't have to do anything. So like I said, Yes Please is kind of easy, and yet it's kind of complex, just complex enough. Were this a non-standard stock Slackware install, for instance, maybe this person is a pro, they've been using Slackware a lot, they know that they never use JPEGs, so they just didn't even bother installing libjpeg, or maybe even more realistically, they don't really use let's just say that they don't have one of those dependencies. When they read that, they'll say, oh gee, I guess libjpeg is actually required for this, I better go install that, and then they can pull that package down from the Slackware server and install that, and then they can install Yes Please. So it's manual dependency resolution. It's a beautiful thing because you actually know what's going into your computer, and you actually get to compile it the way that you want to if it's that important to you. But I digress. So that's the Slack-DESC or description file. The third file that one would do is the yesplease.info file. The .info file is, again, very structured, very specific as to how it needs to be structured. And this, once you see all these packaging formats, it's going to all kind of start to look really, really familiar to each other. So that's kind of neat. So the yesplease.info file starts with a program name, or PRGNAM, and that equals, in this case, quote, Yes Please, end quote. Next line is version. This is tricky with Sigflup's Yes Please, because she didn't follow any kind of established, at least that I know of or that I can tell, an established method of naming her program. So the version in this case is AUG_4_2010. Now, more traditionally, like if you read up on packaging and you go to like Fedora documentation and read up on how to do RPMs or the BSD packagers porter's handbook, then you'll read up and they kind of have like this thing about you should follow this convention. It's not a law or anything like that, but it's a convention, and that is that you have your program name and then a dash and then your version number and then the compression. And that's just kind of how it's done fairly universally, I've found in my very limited experience as a big famous package maintainer with all my, like, three or four packages that I have. So Sigflip flew in the face of that convention and just named it the month and the day and the year that she actually released that version of it on. And at first I didn't really see a problem with that until I started building packages for it. And it seems like every packaging language, as it were, or convention out there demands something completely different. But that's okay. That's what makes this one a little bit fun. So in this case, we're just doing the whole string as the version. Homepage is uberlitehackerforce.deepgeek.us, and then the download equals http://hobones.dogsoft.net/yesplease_aug_4_2010.tgz. So that's all the information so far that like someone like you or me, if we just had the Slack build, we could look at that file right there and figure out where to go to read up more about the application, and even the direct link to the source code for which this Slack build is created. MD5SUM, self-explanatory. And then there's a separate download link and a separate MD5SUM for an x86_64 version. That is obviously only to be used if these are binary packages that we're installing, but we're compiling from source here, so there is no separate download for x86-64. So we don't need to fill that in. We can leave those empty, just two empty quotes. Maintainer is, oh look, there's my name. The email, klaatu@member.fsf.org, and then approved by my friend and fellow Slackware and Slack build user, D. Somero, who I actually interviewed at Southeast Linux Fest, but the recorder wasn't really on the right way, so it didn't quite work. Okay, so now finally we get into the actual build script itself, and this is yesplease.slackbuild, and once again there's that convention. You have to do the name of the application, and you know, capitalization and everything like that, it counts. So it's yesplease.slackbuild, where the S and the B are both capitalized. That's how it's done. You don't want to deviate from that. So like I say, Slack builds, they come with some great templates. And if you go to the Git repository of Slack builds, they have even, I mean, they've got some good templates on the website, slackbuilds.org. If you go to their Git repository, they have templates for everything. For Perl applications, for AutoMake applications, which this is, for CMake stuff, for Java stuff. It's just got all kinds of templates, which are really, really helpful. But generally speaking, obviously I'm not going to just read this line by line, so if you want to go get the package, the Slack build package, and read through the code yourself, that would be a good idea. Most of this is not even my code. This was a pretty simple Slack build. So a lot of this is basically just Robbie Workman and D. Somero and all the guys over at Slack builds. It's just kind of their scripts that everyone else gets to kind of modify and tweak and leech off of, and makes you feel really good about yourself because you wrote a Slack build when really you did, like, you know, 10% of the work, but that's 10 important percents. Okay, so the program name, reiterated here in the script because we need the variable, is yes please. The version, aug_4_2010. The build is $curly bracket build:\1 curly bracket, and that's what that is going to do, is append a -1 to the end of the script. Like, after we've built everything, it's going to have a -1 to show that this is build 1. And then a tag, and the tag is an _sbo. So all the Slack build files, all the packages that you build via Slack builds will have that tag, _sbo. If you go and download a Slack build from, say, Alien Bob's website, who he has a lot of cool packages, then he'll have an _alien tag. For my personal packages that I build for myself, but I don't submit to Slack builds for whatever reason, which isn't all that common, to be honest, but there are some things where I know that the Slack build already exists, but I don't want to submit, I don't want to use their Slack build, so I'll modify it heavily, or I'll just do my own version, and then I'll have it on my computer, so I'll have the _klaatu. So you can tag your files just to kind of differentiate where these packages came from. Notice here as well that we're using variables right here at the top of the script. That's such a great habit to get into, because then you don't have to, you know, you establish your variables right up at the top, and then you don't have to go through the script and, like, do a sed replace or anything like that, you know. Well, you know, sed. You don't have to replace stuff because you only list it once at the very top of the script. So if Sigflup comes out with a really cool new version of Yes Please on August 8th, 2011, You don't have to go through and change that everywhere. You just simply go into your Slack build file, you change the version, you close it, and you build it, and suddenly you've just updated your Slack build package. So this is very, very efficient. And of course, I'm marveling over it, but it's probably like something that programmers have done for years and years and years. I think it's really smart, though. The next chunk of code I'm not going to read through, but it's basically an... Well, it is. It's an if statement with a little case loopy thing in it, and it's establishing the architecture of the machine, and it's done really, really well. This is like just cool, good old-fashioned bash parsing kind of stuff, where you simply tell it to do a uname-m, and if the value returned from uname-m is, for instance, i486, or i-something 86, then we set the architecture as i486. If it is ARM, then we set the architecture, or arch, A-R-C-H, to ARM. And if it is anything, then we set the architecture to whatever that value is. So it's a really cool kind of auto-detection kind of technique. I have taken that chunk of code right there, simple as it may be, probably. I've taken that and just used it on so many different things, so many little bash scripts that I've written, where I just want to get a value and then examine it and set some other variable to whatever that returned. That's it right there. It's done for you. Just go get the template and rip off the code. It's really cool. Okay, so then we set some more variables, and this is kind of cool because most importantly, we set a temporary directory to /temp/sbo. We set a package value to something inside of that temporary directory /package-program name. So meaning that as we build this package, or as Slack builds, you know, the automated script, as it builds this package, it's going to put everything into /temp/sbo/package-program name. So in this case, it'll be package-yes-please. So this is good to know, because if you're packaging and it fails a few times, you can go to /temp/sbo/package-yes-please and look inside of there and see what did, you know, how far did it get, what's going on inside of that package that we're trying to form. And then the output is set to /TMP. Then we go through and set some compiling, like some make flags, basically, and it does this based on that variable that we established just a minute ago, where we did the uname-m. So we did uname-m, and whatever that returned, and if you don't know what uname-m does, open up a terminal right now and type in uname-m, and you will see that it actually gives you the exact architecture of your machine. So in this case, it's x86_64 on the computer that I'm using right now. So we did a uname-m, we got some value, and then we took that value and set the variable arch, A-R-C-H, equals, you know, whatever value we got back from uname-m. So in this chunk of code, we're saying, okay, so if the value of arch equals i486, then slkc flags equals, quote, -02 -m arch equals a486 -m tune equals i686, close quote. Libdir suffix is nothing, because it's a 32-bit system. There, when you go to a libdir, like /usr/lib or /lib, it's just /lib. That would be as opposed to, for instance, a couple of lines down where it says, else if the value of arch equals x86_64, then slkc flags equals -02 -fpic, and the libdir suffix equals 64. So this is very important stuff, because it's looking at the architecture of your computer and setting some pretty common little flags that you want to maybe keep in mind when you're compiling software. And then we do a set /e. The set /e means that we're going to exit the script if there are errors. This is such a great thing, and I never really understood why it was done in Slack builds. I always kept it in because it was in the template. I didn't have a deep understanding of why it was done, and then I started doing a lot more scripting at my job, and I would run a script, and it would run through the whole script, and then I'd look at the results, and it turns out that half of the script didn't actually get done. And I would always think to myself, why did it continue going if it couldn't even find that directory, you know, and just kept working, but it was missing like half of the things that I asked it to do. Well, it turns out that I had never set it to to stop. There was no warning that, hey, if you encounter errors, then bail. So set space dash E will help with that sort of thing. RM space dash RF space dollar sign package. Why would we do that? Well, think about it. If you're building the package and you're trying to build it and it fails, so then you try again. Well, you don't want to try to build the package into itself, right? You don't, or have some kind of conflict where it says directory already exists. So as part of a fairly early step in this process is to look and see if an existing $PKG exists, and if it does, remove it recursively and forcefully. The forcefully flag, of course, is set because otherwise it might, if we have RM set to RM-I, then it would ask us, hey, are you sure you want to remove this? And we don't want that. We want our script to run very, very silently. So RM-RF $package. And then we make some directories. We make a directory called $temp, $package, and $output. And you'll remember, of course, that those are variables that we set earlier in the script. Temp was set to /temp/sbo. Package was set to being in the temporary directory /package-yesplease, or really program name, but in this case, yes please. And then output was set to /tmp. You'll notice that there's a -p flag after the make dir, and what that stands for, what that means is to make any necessary parent directories. Turns out that this is a really handy trick to know, because if you're ever making a number of folders, like you want to make a, I don't know, directory of a bunch of skinny puppy albums, so you'd say make dir skinny puppy, and then you'd have to go into skinny puppy, and then you'd say make dir vivisect, and then you'd say make dir, maybe inside of that you'd have the remixes and the normal ones. You know, if you wanted to do that, you could just do it with one command by saying make all the parent directories that are needed. So you could say make dir -p skinny puppy /vivisect /vivisect live, and then again for the whatever. But the point is that you can actually, it will make everything leading up to that directory for you. You don't have to actually do it in separate commands. It's quite nice. That was way over complex for a very simple explanation. So then you cd into temp. You're sending the shell script, you know, the executor of the shell script into the temporary directory. This can get complex because you have to remember where these commands are being executed from. This is something I try to actually avoid in my own shell scripts because I always get confused. Happily, a lot of this is pre-scripted in the Slack build, so you don't have to really keep track of it as much if it's a simple compile. It's not always that simple, so sometimes it does become tricky. And again, you do an RM-RF of the program and the version, just in case it's already in progress, if it's being built in that temp directory. And then you untar and ungzip, or whatever needs to be done, that program version. So this is the source code that the user will have downloaded on their own and placed in that directory, and it's going to need to untar it. Now, that's a line that obviously you're going to have to change if your source code was tar.gz or tar.bz2 or .zip, whatever it might be. That's kind of a line that you're going to have to keep an eye on if you're building a lot of Slack builds from a template file. And then notice that we cd into that program version and we change the permissions. This is, again, something that's going to be fairly constant in the packaging stuff, where you have to keep in mind that we're building and distributing on Linux and Unix-y systems, so permissions actually are going to matter. The next chunk of code we set the C flags for the compilation process, and we do a /configure with all of the associated options that you may or may not want to have. And this is kind of an important thing, at least to me. It helps you keep everything very consistent, and it helps you make sure that everything actually works. But things like setting the prefix or setting what library directory you want to refer to, where your configuration files are kept. And some programs, like, you know, the more complex programs like FFmpeg, I mean, there's a million different options configuration that you can pass. So Audacity, too, there's a bunch of different ones. So sometimes you'll see a list of configuration options that just take up, well, your whole screen, really. I mean, it can be very complex. So that's a very important part, and the only way to find that out, and really the only way to do a Slack build properly, is to go through the actual source code and run through the compilation process a couple of times. So if we go to the source directory, if we untar it and ungzip it and go into it, and just do a /configure --options or --help. I'm not sure. It seems to depend on the program itself. I've seen both. I don't know what the deciding factor on that is. But the /configure --help will show you a full list of all the potential configuration options that you can pass to the /configure process. So in this case, it's still a screenful. I mean, I've never really seen one of these that's just a couple of lines. But if you read through it, there's some really important stuff. You know, it just kind of, some of the stuff you don't even have to set because there are defaults, and it tells you what the defaults are. For instance, the mandir, wherever the man file is going to go, --mandir equals some dir, and then it says, well, in square brackets, that is prefix /man. Well, what is prefix? Well, go up a little bit to where the /configure option tells us what the prefix is, and it says, okay, the prefix is --prefix equals prefix, and the default is /usr/local. And that's actually kind of funny. I don't remember noticing that before. I actually like usr/local as my default prefix, but I don't know that that's always the prefix, that it's usually just /usr. It seems like a lot of distributions and things are going away from the /local folder, but yeah, that's always interesting to look at. But anyway, the --mandir obviously would not be something that we would need to specify if the default was something that we were perfectly happy with. But if you want to override that, then you certainly can do that as well. And in fact, it looks like in this script, we do override a prefix. We have --prefix equals /usr. So it's not going to be /usr/local, it's just /usr, and that is to keep it consistent with the rest of Slackware. Of course, if for some reason you felt like it doesn't belong in /usr/whatever, like /bin/share/man/whatever, or /share/man, whatever path is going to kind of cascade down from different components of what you're compiling and installing, you could always change that prefix. And it's done. It's done sometimes on particularly large or maybe somewhat intrusive applications. You'll see things that install themselves to /opt/local/bin, or to /usr/local/bin, whatever. One of those two sort of classic, this was installed by a third party, or you know, not a default system kind of application. So for us, though, we're just going to do a simple /usr to be nice and consistent with the rest of Slackware. Then we do a make yes please, and you can see that I did a comment in there that says make install is broken and installs the file to the build system. Now this is funny, I wish I'd read this note to myself a long time ago, actually, because I think when I built it, I obviously knew that, but then when I was doing the RPM of yes please, I ran into that same problem and spent like a day trying to fix it, and I'm just now seeing again my own note to myself in here. But yeah, so Sigflup used an install script that her make file refers to the install script. It runs that install script, and that install script gets some kind of option from, you know, the environment that you're in, and so far on at least two of the systems that I've built a package for, I know it happened on Slack Build, and I know it happened on RPM, that install script just didn't quite, didn't match up with the packaging that I was doing. I could be doing something wrong, but that's what I found. So we do simply make yes please, and then we do an install -d -m0755-s, and then $program name, $package /usr/bin/program name. So what we're doing there is very, very explicitly telling the install where to put the binary that it's about to compile. So the make command, when we said make yes please, what we were doing there is calling out a very specific option in Sigflup's make file. So if you go back to her source code that we just unzipped to look at the configure options, if we go into her make file, well, you won't see a make file unless you did the configure, but you will see a make file .in. If you do a less on that, or cat, or more, whatever you prefer, then you will see that on the left side of the make file, there are words and then series of commands after them. So you've got, like, I'm looking down under all the C flags and prefixes and stuff. You see yes please, and that's simply doing one thing, and then you see an install. So if we'd said make install, what would have happened was yes please chmod plus x dot slash install dot sh, and then dot slash install .sh yes please to the prefix to the bin to yes please. So it's kind of hard-coded in her makefile to do a certain set of commands that we actually don't want to do. So we simply want to make the binary. We don't want to install it, at least not the way that she is installing it. And then on the separate line in our own script, we said install dash d space dash m whatever, and then we said here's where we want you to put the binary, which of course isn't in our system. We're not really installing yes please. We're installing it into that fake little clone, that destination directory that we've created. And where is that directory? Do you remember? Look up in the script, you'll see it. Yes, exactly. It's in slash temp slash sbo, and then of course it's slash package dash yes please. So that's where we're actually installing everything. So if you think about it, all we're doing is a normal everyday source code compile, but every step of the way where something's actually getting compiled, we're redirecting all of the output to the fake system with this fake slash usr slash bin and a fake slash usr slash share slash doc and a fake slash etsy and all these other in a fake slash lib. So that's all that's happening in a package. You're building and putting it into one location that isn't your system, because you don't want to put it into your system yet. You want to put it into a package that you can then distribute among your friends, or you can say, okay, computer, now I want you to overlay this package onto your file system so that, of course, later on when you get tired of that application or when you want to upgrade it, you can very cleanly you have a record of everything that you've just done, and you can uninstall or you can upgrade without jumping through hoops. And that's what packaging is all about, right? And that's why people keep applications and packages and don't just keep installing everything straight out of source code. Alright, so we've got a package that we've installed now. There's not a whole lot of documentation with Sikaflup's application, but there is a README file. And it seems to be a convention of all the packaging stuff that I've seen so far, again, all three of them that I've actually looked at, that if there is documentation, then basically, even if it's not like a man page or something, then you're going to keep track of it. You're going to install that onto the system as well. It's considered part of the application. So in this case, we are going to make a directory with that dash p flag again. You remember how I explained that that makes all the parent directories. And we'll put that into, of course, our package. So that's the package, the $PKG variable. And then, just like I said, we're going to put it into slash usr slash doc slash program dash $version. I kept saying slash user slash share slash doc. I guess it's just slash user slash doc. And then we're going to copy all of the documentation over there, which in this case is all of one file. So you copy cp-a, that makes sure that you get everything recursively and maintains all the different permissions and stuff like that, I think. And then we've got a little slash, but we're just saying copy the README file to that one destination that we've just made, which is the slash usr slash doc slash program version, which of course isn't the real one, it's the one in our destination directory, our package. And then we cat the Slack build itself into that folder as well, into that directory as well. Why copy when you can cat, and why cat when you can copy? It's kind of like in the Slack book, if you've ever read that or if you're ever going to go read that, they've got like, in the same kernel compile lesson, they've got like two or three different ways of copying a file, and there's like literally line after line. It's just like, why did they copy that and cat that? And to this day, I don't know. But, you know, it's helpful to kind of see all the different ways you can do things. And then finally, we're going to make a makedir-p in the package slash install, and into that install folder, we are going to cat from the current directory the slack-description file. And now, if there was a man page that was built for this, and there isn't, there's a yes please space dash dash help, but that's not a file, that's part of the program itself. So there is no man page, so we're not going to do anything with man pages. This had no Perl this didn't have anything else involved, so there's no meta little hidden things to strip out or get rid of. So again, this is a pretty simple build comparatively, but at this point we could do all kinds of cleanup. And again, you're going to see this in the other packages where after you've installed it, you want to kind of clean up after yourself and make sure that you're not leaving a whole bunch of bits and pieces lying around for your user to have to clean up on their own. Tidy up a little bit. And after that, you cd into the package and you issue what is a distinctive Slackware application called makepkg, and it resides in slash sbin slash makepkg. And so we're basically converting everything in this directory that has the exact correct structure and skeletal form of a Slack package, and it's taking all that stuff and putting it into, well, really just a tar gzipped archive. So make PKG, while I say it is specific to Slackware, it actually isn't specific to Slackware at all, because if you do a less on /sbin/ make PKG, you will see the shell script and all the code, or, you know, you'll see the application right there, and it's just a bunch of Unix stuff. It's normal, everyday bash kind of shell kind of stuff that anyone could do. So this is a really, really, I just can't get over how, like, beautiful this format is, because it is it's pure Unix. It's just a bunch of shell scripting, and it's just so effective. Why is it so effective? Well, before we go into that, we should run this script and see what actually happens. So the way that you run a Slackware script, or a Slack build script rather, is that you've got your folder, you've got your little Slack build folder with our four obligatory Slack build files in it, and you place the source code package all zipped up and everything, just like you got it from the internet. You place that inside of that folder. You chmod the Slack build script to be executable, so that's chmod plus x, yesplease.slackbuild, and then become root, su, enter your root password, and then run the script, /yesplease.slackbuild. And that finds the source package sitting next to it. It unzips it, it moves it over into the temporary directory, and builds it and compiles it and all that other stuff that we've just written down in the script. Let's look in /tmp, and we'll see our newly built yesplease_august42010.tgz, _x86-64-1_sbo.tgz. And that is, of course, a normal everyday Slack package that we could then use install PKG to install onto our system. And it simply unarchives that directory and takes all those little bits and pieces and dumps them into your file system where they belong and spits out like a little description for you and stuff like that. And it is truly as simple as that. The really cool thing is that if you ever want to look and see what has been installed on your system in the lifespan of your Slackware system, you can simply do an ls on /var/log/packages, and there they are. All the packages that you've ever installed. Now, those aren't they don't contain the binaries and everything. You know, there's no reason to keep that stuff around, but they do have, it is a list of everything that was installed, and each of those packages contains a file list of everything that was installed. And that's not just for your information, of course, because if you ever went to go do a remove PKG, then the system could look at the file with all of the little folders and directories that it lists as having been part of that install, and it can see if they're unique, you know, make sure that they're not being used by any other package on your system, and if they are unique, then it will remove that file from your system, and that's how remove PKG works. So the install PKG takes your Slack build and overlays it over your file system and records exactly what it has done in a plain text file in your /var/log/packages, and the remove PKG cats that log file and does a unique, or a sort with unique flag probably over everything else, figures out what it can and cannot remove, and then removes it. And you're done. It's that simple. It's that generic. Notice how there's no complex packaging front end. There's no database underlying all of this. It's just shell scripts, plain text, traditional Unix commands. Very, very, very cool. And it's easy enough that someone like me, and you, dear listener, can actually start with on your own. You know, I mean, if you know how to shell script, you basically know how to make a Slack build. Slack builds, that format, that packaging format is the one, I mean, that is what is used by Pat Volkerding to make Slackware. So it's all very cohesive and very tried and tested. It's a very robust little packaging format, very simple, and I think once you do it, or even once you've listened along to me doing that, it does help you understand what's going on during packaging. Because while this is very, well, I keep saying it's non-specific, but this is something that Slackware does, it's all the same idea. It's packaging. So when we do RPM on the next episode, a lot of that is going to sound very familiar to this one. And I do hope that you'll return for that episode on RPMs. But for now, I think we're finished with Slack building. I hope you enjoyed this. I know it's been a long episode. Hope it's been informative. Thanks for listening.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All Binrev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Share Alike, 3.0 license.